Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, you're back with Jay Shapiro. On this first portion of the program, I want to discuss an issue which is becoming really quite critical here in Israel and has to do with the drafting into the army of the ultra-Orthodox. It's always been an issue, but it's become really a super issue in the last couple of weeks because the Supreme Court in Israel has come up with a conclusion that the ultra-Orthodox have to be drafted. Keep in mind, there are presently about 60,000 ultra-Orthodox yeshiva students. When the first state first came into being back in 1948, there were approximately 400. Today, there are approximately 60,000. That's a huge difference. Also, this is a time when Israel really needs manpower in the service of the country. And it has been pointed out by a number of observers who are themselves Orthodox that this situation cannot be allowed to continue. Despite the enormous sacrifices in dead and wounded and kidnapped and displaced, and despite financial deprivation and disruption and trauma experienced by so many Israeli families, both religious and secular alike, the Haredi leadership is not budging from their position that their students do not have to serve. David Weinberg, one of the commentators, adds more to that. He says, forget the military draft of the ultra-Orthodox. How about some concrete expressions of empathy for the sacrifices and burdens carried at this time by the non-Haredi Israeli public? How many Haredi leaders of any stream, whether Lithuanian or Hasidic or Sephardic, have you seen at any one of the many funerals for fallen soldiers on Mount Herzl in Jerusalem? How many significant Haredi figures have shown up at Shiva for soldiers to pay condolences? How many significant Haredi leaders have quietly taken a million of their own boys late night to pray at the Mount Herzl Cemetery? After all, Haredim have a thing about praying at the grave sites of tzaddikim, holy people, and soldiers killed in the defense of Israel are holy people. The Haredi world is overwhelmingly cut off from the war reality that the rest of Israel is living. And this is devastating. This should not be. Really, you have to participate in the society of which you are a part. So even if drastic punitive measures were applied, like a complete cutoff of government funding for everything Haredi. The Haredi schools don't teach basic secular subjects like the reading and writing and arithmetic. So these people are not prepared for even the civilian life in Israel. They get massive subsidies from families of kollelers, people who sit and learn all day, and they get reductions in municipal taxes and health insurance and daycare and so on. David Weinberg says that he reaches a conclusion that the average Haredi adult is what is called a tinok shenishba bein hagedolim, bein hagoyim actually, which is defined as a baby held hostage by others. In other words, if a person has, it says tinok nishba bein hagoyim, a child who's been held hostage by the goyim. In other words, if a kid is taken away from his home when he's a baby by non-Jews and he grows up knowing nothing about Judaism, so it's understood, and he's called a child grown up among goyim. Now, David Weinberg changes that phrase to say tinok shenishba bein hagedolim, a baby held hostage by the great leaders of the Haredi rabbinic world. So it's a very bad situation, and there is no solution on the horizon for the current constitutional, political, and social crisis over Haredi draft exemption. That is the situation right now. Maybe it'll change in time, but that right now is the situation. So Weinberg goes on to say what remains possible and necessary is to distinguish Haredi ideology regarding military service from authentic Torah ideology. To rigorously reject Haredi dogma in this matter and debunk Haredi distortion of religious sources. This is an obligation. And I'm going to quote what David Weinberg says. He's very knowledgeable, and I want to share this information with the listeners. There are four pseudo-foundational concepts that Haredi ideologues cite in the refusal to participate in carrying the burden of military service. First, there is something called Rabbanan lo tzricha niturita, that Torah scholars do not need protection because they are protected by the heavens. This is a distortion of the meaning of a phrase in the Babylonian Talmud, which doesn't at all refer to wars of defense, but everyday policing tasks. This is described in detail in the Encyclopedia Judaica. What it says is that Torah scholars do not have to do everyday policing. We're not talking about wars. They're saying that in the old time, in the old communities, you had to have guards that could walk around at night and make sure everybody was safe. Torah scholars do not have to do that nighttime guarding. Why? Because the Torah protects them. That's what it actually means. The Torah scholars don't mean guarding. It's not talking at all about wars. It's talking about everyday policing of the community in which you live. If you're busy learning Torah, you're free of this everyday policing. There is also an aphorism that says, Torah magna umatzla. Torah protects and saves. It's in the Babylonian Talmud that all one needs for protection from the Jewish people's enemies is a spiritual effort, whether through religious observance or charity or study. The modern Haredi interpretation is a distortion of this phrase. This is not what the Talmud meant. When Haredi people get sick, they go to the doctor, they go to the hospital, in addition to praying or giving charity. So the same thing applies on a national level. If you were to believe that just by praying or just by studying that's enough, then you wouldn't go see a doctor when you got sick. Obviously, this is not true. The And even if one accepts the concept that Torah studies a critical component of the Jewish people, and I do, it is, the Torah study of Haredi kids or 45-year-old adults is sufficient. In other words, all right, Torah study is important. That doesn't mean that the guys of army age should not serve. You can learn study before that, learn Torah before army age. You can learn Torah after army age. You can learn Torah even when you're in the army. I know many people, real Torah scholars, who have served in the army. In other words, not to serve because you're learning Torah is simply an excuse that has no basis. The Torah, Haredi community considers itself that they're an oasis of purity and morality, something that must be preserved for the overall good of Israel. Now, there is no doubt that Haredi society is a place of kindness and commitment. If you take a look at the phone book of the Haredi communities, like B'nai Brak, the first pages of the phone book are filled with organizations who provide services for the community free of cost, whether it's lending clothing to people, lending beds, whether it's doing babysitting, anything that has to do with helping your neighbor for free is done in the Haredi community. There is no doubt about that. You don't see this in the Tel Aviv phone book. You see it in the B'nai Brak phone book. But that doesn't mean that you should be totally disconnected and reject general education and gainful employment, and to be disconnected from the rest of the public and from the state. That corrupt thinking ends up justifying ignorance of all knowledge outside religious texts. They don't learn basic spelling or arithmetic in some of these yeshivas. And if there is the fear that these Haredi youth, if they go into the army, they'll be exposed to other ways of life, that is a justifiable Haredi concern that the military service at a young age would expose their youth to the possibility of other ways of life and could erode the identity characteristics of future generations. That is a real fear, but it can be dealt with. They could have special units. They already have in the army special Haredi units. For example, these Haredi units, they're all men. There are no girl soldiers. In other words, the Haredi community can be provided what it needs and is already being provided what it needs, so it can carry the burden of defending this country. That is why there is such a thing called the Chesder Yeshiva, which combines Torah learning with army service. My own sons went to Chesder Yeshivas, and my grandchildren went to Chesder Yeshivas. They all serve. The Chesder Yeshiva provides a context within which students can focus upon their education while heeding the call to public service. It enables them to maintain an integrated Jewish existence despite the conflict of values, lifestyle, and sensibility. The late great Dr. Aaron Lichtenstein was the dean of the Chesder Yeshiva in Har Etzion, south of Jerusalem, and he was a proponent of such yeshivas, and he spoke about it and he defended the idea of having a Hesder Yeshiva. He wrote that, and I quote, "The halachic rationale for Hesder Yeshivas rests upon the simple need for physical survival and the fact that military service is often the fullest manifestation of what's called gemilat chasadim, of helping your neighbor, an action on behalf of your neighbor, which is one of the three cardinal foundations of the world. That's the basis of Jewish social ethics, its realization, even at some cost to single-minded devotion to Torah scholarship. But it's imperative. In contemporary Israel, the greatest single chesed, the greatest single good deed that one can perform is helping to defend the homeland and the very lives of his neighbors. And it's inspiring to behold. The whole idea of the Hesder Yeshiva, combining Torah learning with army service, was to so that the people who undertook to go to these yeshivas would, in a sense, respond to their responsibility to both worlds, to the worlds of learning and to the worlds of protecting your society. That was the basis of the Hesder Yeshiva. Through Hesder Yeshivas, tens of thousands of students have gone in the last, I think, 40 years. And that is something we believe in. To not wish to defend your neighbor now is simply wrong. And those of us who believe in combining Jewish religious education and army service have found that the Hesder Yeshiva is the solution, and it is a solution that even the Haredis can use. To avoid doing so is really bad. I don't want to say sinful, like I don't judge what's a sin, but the fact to avoid military service has absolutely nothing to do with authentic Torah laws, and that's something that has to be resolved. Otherwise, it's going to tear our society apart. I'll be back after the break.
How did a nice Jewish girl from Delaware end up living in Israel? Shalom, I'm Natalie Sapinski. Join me on my show, Returning Home. Meet different people who have moved to Israel. Hear their personal stories, their highs, their lows, and everything in between. Each week, we talk to experts on immigration and the process of moving to Israel. Listen to Returning Home.
Every Sunday on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to continue on the topic that I began in the first portion of the program about the ultra-Orthodox serving in the army. Today, there are a lot of issues that divide our people, and since the war began back in October, a lot of those issues have been put aside. They were burning issues before the war started, but now among the burning issues, if not the issue, is the one of the ultra-Orthodox serving. Right now, the dispute over whether every citizen should bear an equal burden in supporting the state creates tremendous resentment. It's not a new issue, but it has grown quite a bit over the years since the state was founded, particularly because the Haredi community has grown. As I mentioned previously, at the time when the state was founded in 1948, there were 400 students in yeshivot. Today, there are 60,000. That is a huge difference. So we have to share the burden of fighting our enemies. We have to solve it equitably, and and otherwise the national unity may be torn, and that would be terrible. So the imperative for all able-bodied individuals to step forward and serve is magnified in the case of an existential threat when the entire country is threatened, as it is today. At such times, the Talmud says that military service is obligatory and applies to everyone. The expression used in the Talmud is, all must go, even a bridegroom from his bridal canopy and her bride from her chuppah. In other words, what's called a mechemet mitzvah, an obligatory war to save the Jewish people. Despite the military leader's initial dismissal of the Gaza war as a skirmish, this war in which we are now engaged has been an existential conflict from the beginning, and a new front might be opened on the Lebanese border with Hezbollah. Right now we're fighting Hamas in Gaza, but we're also threatened from Hezbollah, which is supported by Iran, on our Lebanese border. And this is the fact. Now, in the first portion of the program, I quoted a lot from what was said by David Weinberg. David Weinberg is an Orthodox Jew. He's a senior managing fellow at the Miskov Institute for National Security and Zionist Strategy. It's located here in Jerusalem. So I quoted from him during the first portion of the program. Now, I want to base a lot of what I'm going to say now on Rabbi Stuart Weiss, who's a rabbi in Ranana, a good friend of mine, and he, of course, is in favor of the Haredim serving. And he wrote that Haredi rabbis have given four primary reasons why they shouldn't serve. And he responded to each of these four reasons. And I want to quote pretty much what he says, because I think it's important for the listeners to hear what an intelligent and knowledgeable rabbi says about a situation that's really difficult now. First of all, the rabbi quotes something in the Talmud. In the tractate Megillah, it says that one who studies Torah is God's creation, and my friend who does other labor is also God's creation. Let no one say one is better than the other. For one who brings a substantial sacrifice and one who brings a meager sacrifice have equal merit before God. It says that in Tractate Brachot. So while heads of yeshivas may consider their students the elite, and parents of soldiers hold their children to be the elite, both sides must be able to recognize the achievements of the other. You need both study and defense. There's no two ways about it. This is the actuality in which we live. Now, there are those who claim that the yeshiva students go to war. Who will keep the Torah alive? Well, the answer to that also is that the draft of yeshiva students will not be all-inclusive at any one time. The vast majority will remain in their studies. In addition, we have hundreds, if not thousands, of soldiers in the Hesder yeshivas and the Nachal Haredi programs who are brilliant Torah students, have successfully combined their study and service. The Torah will never be deserted. I quoted this in the first part of the program, Rabbi Lichtenstein. You can do both. It's interesting that throughout history, some of the greatest religious figures are also Torah giants. Joshua, who was the assistant to Moses, King David led an army that conquered Jerusalem. Rabbi Akiva joined with Bar Kokhba in a rebellion against Rome. And that, unfortunately, that didn't work out, but it didn't matter. Torah did not falter as a result of their service. So the next argument you hear from the ultra-Orthodox is, we were in this land of Israel before there was a state, so why should we now be forced to do things we never had to do before? That's their argument. They said they were here anyhow, before there was a Jewish state. So the history is not static. Times change. Conditions change. And what you have to do is to adapt to changing conditions. The Israeli government provides tremendous benefits to its citizens, to all its citizens. They even give massive financial support for Torah study, so that more people, believe it or not, are learning Torah today than at any other time in Jewish history. I think there are more yeshiva students just in Jerusalem than there were in all of Babylonia and the land of Israel 2,500 years ago, and they're being supported by the government. The Haredi community must not think it can create a state within a state that have rules and regulations that differ from everybody else. The law of the land is the operative law, and it says that in the Talmud. Even if the government is not a Jewish government, you must obey the laws of the land. That is what keeps society together. The taxes and traffic laws and citizenship requirements and everything else. You must obey the laws of the land. There's no two ways about it. So, If you refuse to subscribe to the dictates of a Zionist state, they have the opportunity to democratically seek change or leave the country. But the state has laws. You must obey the laws of the state. And if the state requires military service, so be it. Now, one of the arguments of the Orthodox, the ultra-Orthodox, is if they go in the army, it'll weaken their students' religiosity. Now, it's true. That can happen. My argument is that if you raise a person and educate it properly, that's not going to happen. It's incumbent upon us to create frameworks that maintain the proper standards of religious practice to protect the religious identity of all our soldiers, as much as possible in times of war. For example, the food in the army is kosher food. I remember I once heard a very interesting personal story. You know, not only is the food in the army kosher, but it's also kept kosher for Passover. And I once knew a girl, she was not religious, but she served in an army base where there were no religious soldiers in Sinai. And she told me a personal story that the chief rabbi of the army came to visit the base, and she offered him something to eat. And he refused to eat because he felt that the kitchen wasn't kosher enough for him. So she said to the rabbi, "Rabbi, there is not one single religious soldier in this camp. We keep this place kosher because that is the army law. If you come here and refuse to eat from this kitchen that we non-religious people keep kosher, we will stop keeping it kosher." This is an actual incident told to me by this girl. So the rabbi ate, because she was 100% correct. If these are the rules, these are the rules. And if you obey the rules, then everybody, even the chief rabbi, should be able to eat there. And if he refuses to, there's no point in keeping the rules. So Rabbi Weiss goes on to draw some very interesting conclusion I want to share with the listeners. You can't forcibly draft the entire Haredi community into the army, but neither can that community continue to evade military service. Therefore, he suggests some compromises. Haredim of military age who do not study, which is about 30%, must be drafted or imprisoned if they don't. They can be placed in non-combat roles and things like that because they're not properly prepared for combat, but they should serve. Women of military age should be required to do part in national service. My own daughters did that, and several of my granddaughters did that. Also, several of my granddaughters serve in the army. They're still active. Also, Arab citizens who get all the benefits of being Israeli citizens must serve, perhaps not in combat roles. They don't want to fight against other Arabs, but there's things they can do. All who do serve in the army should receive financial benefits over and above those who not serve. And the rabbi suggests something else, which actually I also had the same idea. All yeshivas should be established on military bases to host those with legitimate exemptions, thus increasing their contact with soldiers, and yeshiva students should keep photos of current soldiers in front of them, devoting their study to them. And the recitation of prayer for the soldiers must be mandatory in all synagogues. There are many synagogues in Israel do not say the prayer for the soldiers. I think that's really wrong. Also, there are times off from learning, like in the summertime. Yeshiva students should be required to assist in community service, like agricultural work and things of that nature. There's a famous passage in the Talmud. It says, the first temple was destroyed due to people's cardinal sins of bloodshed, idolatry, and sexual immorality. But the second temple, the people occupied themselves with Torah and mitzvot and acts of kindness. So why was it destroyed? Because of baseless hatred, what's called in Hebrew, sinat chinam. This teaches you that baseless hatred is equal to the three sins of idolatry, illicit relations, and murder. But if the people studied Torah and kept the commandments, why was this baseless hatred? Because the people just didn't behave properly. If you don't share in the collective needs of the entire nation, the effort to defend itself against enemy attack, then all the acts of religiosity would not save us, and it will create hatred, which is really not baseless. If they don't serve, it'll generate hatred and animosity, which is not for the whole nation. So, we have to realize we are presently in a war for our survival. Everyone must participate in that struggle. Everyone to the best of their ability. And that means everyone. And everybody's abilities are different. It doesn't matter. You have to serve as you can. You are not exempt from contributing to the communal effort for the survival of our society. That is the bottom line. I'll be back after the break.
Shalom, this is Nadia Matar from the Sovereignty Movement. At a time when there is so much disinformation, you have to know who to listen to know what really is going on in Israel. Israel News Talk Radio is the radio where you can know that what you hear is the truth.
Israel News Talk Radio.
Straight Talk from Israel.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. The first thing I want to say on this portion of the program, I have a number of subjects that I want to touch upon, but I want to mention that a spokesman for the Israeli government, who asked to be unnamed for some reason, said the following: the Iranian nuclear program, which is Tehran's highest and most coveted priority, has also seen the regime of the Ayatollahs capitalize on intimidation of the West, especially now that they noted the weakness of the American president. The illusion that the nuclear crisis can be settled with a few signatures on a stack of papers is too strong of an urge for the West to forego. Iranian bellicosity worries the West and makes it want a deal as quickly as possible. The West wants a deal, and it's obvious by the American spokesman. A quid pro quo in Iran's favor with the West can live with, but one with Israel absolutely cannot. The West can live with the buildup of a nuclear Iran. Israel cannot. In a multipolar world, Israel is a country that is a pole unto itself. Israel is a nation that has faced superpower challenges for decades from its very beginning. For weeks, there was an attempt by the United States and other Western countries, as well as various international bodies, to pressure and tried to persuade Israel not to take Rafah and the Gaza Strip. Israel is instead smashing Hamas, ISIS, and Rafah, and the adjacent Philadelphia corridor is in Israel's hands. Israel is going ahead with its war despite others trying to tell Israel to slow down. When necessary, Israel do the same on all the other fronts near and far, where its vital interests are at stake and its survival threatened. Pressure from friend, pressure from foe, or both will never change that. Israel is in a struggle for survival and do what it needs to survive, regardless of what others are recommending. That was a comment by an unnamed Israeli diplomat, and I don't know why he wanted to remain unnamed, but I quoted what he said because it makes a lot of sense. Israel do what it will have to. Now I want to go on to a number of subjects that are under the radar. They're not related to each other, but you don't get these items if you read the general newspapers and listen to the radio. They're tucked away in little items in the back of newspapers. The first one is the following. New immigrants to Germany seeking German citizenship will now be required to affirm that they accept Israel's right to exist and to tolerate the presence of Jews in Germany. This was announced by the German Interior Ministry last week. Germany's Interior Ministry announced that it has modified the naturalization process for gaining German citizenship with the goal of cutting down required to become a citizen while imposing tighter conditions for German citizenship. So the Interior Ministry put out a statement and said, in response to increasing anti-Semitism in Germany, the list of questions in the naturalization test has been expanded. New exam questions have been added on the topic of anti-Semitism, the right of the State of Israel to exist, and Jewish life in Germany. At the same time, the Interior Ministry has streamlined the immigration process, dropping the requirement that new citizens must surrender their citizenship to their previous home country, and lowering the residence requirement for immigrants employed in Germany from 8 years to 5 years. Among other changes, the ministry changed the loyalty declaration, which new immigrants must affirm in order to receive citizenship. The question now includes two questions related to Germany's special historical responsibility for the National Socialist unjust regime and its consequences, especially for the protection of Jewish life. What are the new questions asked prospective citizens? Which action relating to the State of Israel is forbidden in Germany? And the correct answer is publicly calling for the destruction of Israel. However, according to a statement by the Interior Ministry spokesperson, if an applicant incorrectly answers the question, they will not be automatically rejected, but will instead be questioned further regarding their views to ascertain whether they reject the existence of Israel, and if so, whether it is based on anti-Semitic attitude. If an applicant questions Israel's right to exist, for example, the citizenship authorities can question in the naturalization process whether such statements are based on anti-Semitic attitude. By contrast, the German state of Saxony-Anhalt requires naturalization applicants to affirm their acceptance of Israel's right to exist. So that's a news item. It's really rather astonishing. In other words, today to become a citizen of Germany, you have to affirm Israel's right to exist. Now, we're talking now, 80 years after the Second World War. It's interesting that at this late date, Germany is doing what it's doing. In other words, in order to become a German citizen today, you have to admit that Israel has a right to exist. I don't think there's any other country in the world that has that requirement for citizenship. I'm sure not. That has that requirement for citizenship, including, of course, the United States also. So it didn't get a big headline, but I really think it's interesting and important. I want to touch upon another subject, the United Nations. I'm old enough to remember when the United Nations came into being in 1945. It was thought that it would be a force for good. Over the years, it's turned out not to be at all. Alan Baker, who used to be a senior lawyer at the Office of Legal Advisor of the United Nations, every now and then writes some kind of column about the United Nations. He came up with one this week, and I think it's important. I want to quote a couple of things from it. In a really shameful statement, the Iranian UN missions official, the ambassador, spoke at the UN and using UN official Twitters, said that Iran is promised to obliterate Israel if Israel attacks Hezbollah in Lebanon. Obviously, nobody was really surprised by such a statement coming from a senior Iranian official, because they have these threats to annihilate Israel coming out of on a daily basis from the Iranian political military leadership. However, what is shocking is the fact that the ambassador's threatening statement was issued by an Iranian official on the UN mission's Twitter account, and by no less than their permanent UN representative. So here, a guy got up in the UN, official representative of Iran, and using the official voice of the UN, said they're going to annihilate Israel. And yet there was no criticism by anyone, including the UN Secretary General Guterres. Now, the UN Secretary General is the guardian of the UN, and nobody called the Iranian ambassador to task for such a violent statement, which violates the basic tenets and principle behind the very existence of the United Nations. The Charter of the United Nations, I looked this up, the very basis of the functioning of the organizations refers specifically in its paragraphs to the determination of all members of the organization, and I quote, to practice tolerance, live together in peace with one another as good neighbors, and to ensure by the acceptance of principles and institutional methods that armed force shall not be used save in the common interest. Also, the opening article of the UN Charter refers to the obligation of all states to maintain international peace and security, and to that end to take effective collective measures for the prevention and removal of all threats to peace and for the suppression of acts of aggression or other breaches of peace, and to be a center for harmonizing the actions of nations in the attainment of these common ends. That is what the UN Charter says. And now you have these guys getting up in the UN, using the UN media to call for the destruction of Israel. Now, the UN appears to regularly demonstrate enthusiasm, efficiency, and rushing to condemn Israel, even when they rely on false or inaccurate and questionable data provided by the UN bodies that are openly hostile to Israel, as well as upon slanting media reporting. They evidently prefer to turn a blind eye to Iran's behavior in openly abusing the UN Charter. So the UN is coddling the Iranians by, and there are other UN countries that are coddling Iran. So the United States has really gone downhill, and it's really had a dramatic reduction in any credibility and effectiveness that it might have had in the past. So that in itself raises the question whether after 80 years of functioning, it's high time that the serious world powers rethink the entire concept of a world organization, because all of this is in light of the fact that the UN has been utterly hijacked, taken hostage by those bent on destroying Israel. Instead of being an organ for peace, the UN turns out is just the opposite. The question you have to ask yourself, is that what the founding fathers of the United Nations intended? I think not. And I often wonder why Israel hasn't simply quit the UN. But I understand there are all kinds of reasons, because Israel belongs to some of the UN organizations that help people around the world, etc. But the UN, which rose in my own lifetime, has turned out to be a really bad failure, certainly when it comes to Israel. Israel stays in the UN for its own reasons, but it is no doubt that the organization has become meaningless in terms of furthering world peace. On to another topic. Last week, in the heart of the Jewish community in Los Angeles, there was an anti-Semitic attack in the most densely populated Jewish neighborhood on the West Coast. There was a well-organized anti-Semitic attack. They came dressed and armed. There was a coordinated plan to intimidate, harass, impede, and assault Jews. That's what happened in the Jewish community in Los Angeles. And Los Angeles, by the way, has the second largest Jewish population in the world outside of Israel. The largest, of course, is New York. So what happened was the Jewish Federation made contact with the local authorities. And this past week, in partnership with the Jewish Community Foundation and an organization called the Tepper Foundation, they gave $1.3 million to over 50 Jewish institutions to pay for additional security needs. They met with the Los Angeles mayor and the chief of police and so forth. Apparently, these efforts are not enough because the environment, the anti-Jewish environment, is increasingly hostile to Jewish existence in a place like Los Angeles. So they need more collective action to ensure their safety. But they $1.3 million to over 50 Jewish institutions to pay for protection. So that gives you an idea of what the situation for Jews in the United States is, and says something about the growing rise of anti-Semitism, something we could not have imagined just a few years ago. It's unfortunate, but it's true. And the Jewish community is responding to the anti-Semitism, which is good. I'll be back after the break.
Warning. Take cover. The Jewish Truth Bomb is here. The show that will explode all the false narratives and fake news. Join host Lenny Goldberg each week as he wires the news together and detonates it through biblical verses that will deliver a shockwave that will blow you away. Don't miss it. The Jewish Truth Bomb. Every Monday.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. You know, Israel as a country are more isolated and more hated than we were before October 7th. Israelis are banned from scientific and academic meetings. Israeli scholarship is scorned. Israel is being told all the time that we're violating humanitarian laws, and all kind of lawyers are criticizing us using legalisms. And everything they're doing, everything they're telling us about this situation, like using legal arguments against us, are totally inapplicable to the situation on what's happening in Gaza today. We're being blamed, for example, for causing a famine in Gaza. Yet the water is flowing, and Israel is allowing trucks with food to come in. What happens is the Hamas prevents the food convoys from reaching distribution centers. Hamas terrorists steal the food for themselves. This week, the Wall Street Journal reported that the United Nations could not distribute the food. They every day, like 1,000 trucks come into Gaza, and the food is looted by the Palestinians. These so-called resistance fighters steal food and supplies and hundreds of millions of shekels from the bank accounts of their Palestinian brothers. If there is a famine and if there is poverty in Gaza, it is not Israel that's to blame. It is Hamas that's to blame. And everybody tells us there's a two-state solution, that it's the only path to peace in the Middle East. They talk about a Jewish state in the pre-1967 borders and a peaceful Palestinian state living side by side with Israel. So it's disingenuous to forget that back in June 1967, Egypt, under President Nasser, blocked the Straits of Tehran, kicked out the UN, and was ready to annihilate Israel by coordinated attacks with Syria and Jordan. And these pre-1967 borders obviously did not lead to peace. So they're not interested in the two-station solution. Under Egyptian rule, there was a time when Egypt ruled Gaza, and the Palestinians were treated very badly by the Egyptians. No attempt was made, for example, to integrate the Palestinians into Egyptian society. They were educated and indoctrinated to believe that Israel was a temporary aberration that soon would be eliminated. There were frequent attacks by these so-called Fedayeen from Gaza, and it really made life in southern Israel tenuous back in the 1950s. It's very interesting when you think about it, looking at it historically. Up until 1967, Israel had very bad economic living conditions, and the country was run by a socialist bureaucracy. And it was more or less tolerated by the left all over the world. This changed after 1973, when Israel won the war, and Israel developed into a Western-oriented economy and a state-of-the-art military industry. So, assured of its survival, Israel stopped being the darling of the left. Subsequently, the left became the leaders for resistance movements, with the Palestinian refugees as their poster children. This portrayal of the Palestinian people and their leaders as a major contributor to the conflict and refusal of the Palestinians to live side by side with Israel was the reality. So, and the citizens of Gaza suffered under the Egyptians, under the Palestinians. Now, obviously, it's very sad. They are human beings and they're suffering. However, their suffering is not a result of Israel. It's a result of the failure of the Palestinian leadership to develop a government during the last 55 years, to design elective procedures that would create an infrastructure to provide over their people in a non-corrupt manner, and to work together with Israeli government to formulate a stable, peaceful relationship. The crux of the problem is that they didn't do this. It's very interesting. Israel's being blamed for what the Palestinians did. Now, Israel is in a war, and a lot of countries are recognized as non-existent Palestinian state. And there's a lot of other countries saying they're going to follow suit. But it's unclear what this really means. However, it is an attack on Israel. How do these members of the Democratic West envisage the reactions of Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran to their decision to recognize a Palestinian state? Do they expect that the terrorist states will evolve to be less violent? Will these tyrants offer freedom of choice to their citizens? Will they build hospitals and schools to save lives instead of building tunnels in order to kill their Jewish neighbors? Will they stop firing rockets, many of which harm their own Palestinian people? The answer, obviously, is they won't. It's interesting. A leader of the Palestinians, a spokesman named Dr. Ghazi Hamad, said the following, and I quote, "There will be a second, a third, and a fourth October 7th. We will repeat this act until Israel is annihilated. They kill indiscriminately. I don't have to tell the listeners what the Palestinians have been up to. We all know this. The goal of Hamas is the destruction of the state of Israel. That's the long and the short of it. And absolutely nothing has changed. Even though Israel has killed and removed Hamas from a large part of Gaza, it still exists and it still lives with the same goal to destroy the state of Israel. As long as the Palestinians are taught and believe that Jews are foreigners in this land, then nothing will change. This won't be possible as long as Hamas rules the Palestinian people. They're educated against us, they're armed against us, and therefore they must be destroyed. I don't know what the solution is. What will happen after we win this war? And we have to win this war. I have no idea what will happen. And I don't think anybody else does either. One day, this war, this Israeli-Palestinian war, is going to end. So then who's going to lead the Palestinians afterwards? The Palestinian Authority has failed. They give terrorists and their families incentive for murdering Israelis. There are dominant families in Gaza and in the West Bank that are run by Arab leadership, by sheikhs. They have no enthusiasm for keeping this role. What about the UN peacekeepers? They failed. There is not seen, no one has shown or come up with a workable solution after this war is over. Nothing can happen as long as Hamas remains viable. If Israel is forced into a ceasefire before destroying this terrorist group, the result will likely be a terrorist-led insurgency that result in hostilities and lead to a future October 7th. So you can't appease Hezbollah, and it's a very difficult problem. When everybody's asking, what are you going to do the day after, you have to realize something. The day after, what they call the day after, can begin only when Hamas and all these jihadist terrorists are no longer a threat. You don't have to worry now about the day after. What we have to be concerned around right now is destroying Hamas. And then we'll start to worry about the day after. These are the facts on the ground. I want to now go on to an entirely different subject. Again, it's one that doesn't get big headlines, and that's why I chose to speak about it. I'm talking about the media in England, in the United Kingdom. The truth of the matter is, in any society, the role of the media is highly influential in shaping public opinion. From Israel's perspective, the United Kingdom is one of the most important and influential countries in the world, yet it is home to media outlets that often take a stance that is anti-Israel, if not downright anti-Semitic. For example, there's a very popular paper in England called The Guardian. The Guardian Daily is an example of the distortions in its treatment of Israel. It's interesting, by the way, when it's owned by something called the Scott Trust Limited, whose aim, when created in 1936, was to secure the financial and editorial independence of the Guardian in perpetuity and to safeguard the journalistic freedom and liberal values of the Guardian free from commercial or political interference. Those are the goals of the newspaper as declared back in 1936. However, right now, they're not meeting their goals. Articles by a number of Guardian journalists are really poisonous against Israel, and they display a callous disregard for the truth, preferring to spew torrents of anti-Semitic hatred. And I don't want to go into all the details. I don't want to bore the listeners. For years, the Guardian has influenced anti-Israeli and anti-Semitic consciousness, and even going far as to print anti-Semitic cartoons that are reminiscent of Nazi propaganda. This is very interesting, the Guardian has negated that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Whenever it reports from Israel, it says it's reporting from Tel Aviv. 6 months after October 7th, and the Guardian published an article claiming that the state of Israel was nearing its end. This is what the Guardian has been doing. A woman named Deborah Orr, who is the editor of the Guardian Weekly, it's a magazine, claimed that Jewish racism was the reason for Israel's 2011 liberation of 2,027 Palestinians jailed in Israel for a single soldier at that time. A lot of Israelis were against it, and these liberated Palestinian prisoners went on to become terrorists. I was about to say they would become terrorists again, but they never stopped being terrorists. The editor-in-chief of The Guardian, a woman named Catherine Viner, was a partner in the creation of an anti-Israel propaganda play about the activist Rachel Corrie, who was killed in 23 when standing in front of a bulldozer while attempting to interfere with the anti-terrorist activities of the Israeli army in Gaza. So we have a situation where this famous, long-time, prestigious newspaper in the United Kingdom is anti-Semitic openly. If you follow its articles every day, and there are people who do so, you see that the paper is anti-Semitic, which is really very shameful, to put it at least, for a major newspaper in Great Britain. They really had to be ashamed of themselves. By the way, there's an election coming up in Britain this week, and many politicians in Great Britain are fearful of their political status if they come out against the violence of extremists in Muslim society in Great Britain, since Islam is the second largest religion in the United Kingdom, the second largest. In the 2021 census, there were 3.8 million residents identified as Muslim, which is 6.5% of the population. Over 30% of the voters in 20 constituencies in Great Britain are Muslim. So the Muslim Vote Movement, and there is an organization called the Muslim Vote, seeks to increase awareness among Muslim voters of their ability to change the political situation in their countries of residence for the benefit of the entire Islamic nation. By the way, that is happening today in Michigan in the United States. It's something we didn't even think of a couple years ago. The main activity of these Muslim organizations in the West is the mobilization of public opinion toward the Palestinian cause, combined with the weakening of support for Israel and its international isolation, because they see this as a preliminary step in the elimination of Israel. So we have a big problem in some of the states in the United States, as well as in Great Britain, a problem that we didn't have just a few years ago. So we have to keep an eye on what's happening. I'll be back after the break.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You're back with Jay Shapiro, and on this part of the program, I want to first of all cite some statistics that don't get the headlines, and I feel it's my responsibility to the listeners to let them know what's happening under the headlines. First of all, let's talk about the number of Jews who experience cases of ethnic bias. More than 1 in 10 American Jewish adults say they were frequently treated poorly or harassed due to their religion, according to a new Gallup poll. An additional 25% said treatment happened occasionally. A majority of American Jews, something like 60%, said they feel uncomfortable sharing their religious affiliation. Far more than 25% of Americans in general. In addition, close to half of all Americans, with all Americans, half of them, view anti-Semitism as a very serious problem, according to the Gallup poll, which is more than 5 times the proportion of respondents said so, and the last time the polling firm asked the same question 20 years ago. The poll about harassment confirmed recent surveys by American Jewish Committee and others of increased insecurity among American Jews. In this Gallup poll on anti-Semitism in the U.S., American adults overall were asked the same question they were asked in 2003, 20 years ago. Do you think that anti-Semitism or prejudice against Jewish people is currently a very serious problem, somewhat of a problem, not much of a problem, or not a problem at all in the United States? This year's poll found that the poll, by the way, is of all Americans, 49% of respondents say it's a very serious problem, 32% say it's something of a problem, which means that a total of 81% of the people polled, Jews and non-Jews, who believe it is a problem. So the poll was a little over 2,000 American adults, and it was the poll was taken in May, and this now and a similar poll was taken by the Pew Research Center. that found that 82% of Americans said there was either a lot or some discrimination against Jews, although 40% said there was a lot of discrimination. So, by the way, it shows that anti-Semitism is pretty high in the United States. And for the first time, by the way, the Gallup poll asked the same question about discrimination against Muslims, and Americans seem somewhat less concerned about Islamophobia. Most of them don't even know much about it, think about Muslims. Anyhow, these are the results of both the Gallup poll and the other poll, the one taken by the American Jewish Committee. It said something I think people should know about, that anti-Semitism is a pretty big thing. We thought with the Second World War, we thought we'd kill anti-Semitism. On the same topic, by the way, a couple other items that are not in the headlines, and they don't even appear in most of the newspapers. You have to search the news media on the computer to find the information. But I'll give you some examples of these things that are really under the headlines, under the radar. Three pro-Israeli attendees of a public event called Strategic Lessons on the Palestinian Resistance. So three pro-Israel attendees were attacked and forcibly dragged out by anti-Israel activists. This took place in North Carolina. The event was one of multiple anti-Israel sessions that took place during a three-day book fair. The Jews who were in attendance were frightened, and it turned out that the three pro-Israeli attendees were seated quietly along a far wall. Anti-Israel activists asked them to put on masks, which they did. At one point, they simply began to beat up on the Jews. So, interesting enough, another thing, by the way, I don't know what this really means, but 80% of the attendees were women. And while the Jews were being beaten, a group of men stood over the pro-Israeli attendees and loudly clapped their hands, yelling, "Free Palestine!" In other words, there was active brutality against people supporting Israel in this institute in North Carolina. Again, it's something that didn't get into the headlines. Very unfortunate. In North Carolina, of all places. I mentioned before in this program that there was an attack at an Adas Torah synagogue in Los Angeles. It was an Israeli real estate event, which very quickly escalated into a violent assault on Jewish congregants. And videos showed masked individuals clad in keffiyehs and physically attacking worshippers. The law enforcement sources revealed about 150 people showed up against the Jews. About 60 cops showed up, but it spiraled out of control before street brawls occurred, and then the police finally took control. You have this one other thing on the same subject. Israeli students at Harvard University are being faced dire exclusion on campus, and other students are suffering because of political litmus tests to participate in clubs and activities. Harvard University, one of the great American universities, now they're wondering what to do. And officials, the authorities, universities, to put out instructions what to do in case of this anti-Semitism. And that makes Harvard the second elite college to receive official guidance to address campus anti-Semitism. All of this has happened since October. Also, Stanford University in California. The report on anti-Semitism at Stanford University, by the way, was 146 pages long. And it detailed examples of Jewish students' experience on campus. At Harvard was only 6 pages compared to 146 from Stanford. So they said they won't put out a more intensive study in the fall. So according to the heads of the university, they said the situation has become quite grave over the last year, and unless significant steps are taken by the beginning of the coming academic year, they could be in a position similar to last year, which they would like to prevent. So that's what's happening on these campuses in the United States. It's only the things that get into the news. But by the way, one of the things that they say they'll have to do is better communication about harassment. Doesn't say they would do so much to do about the harassment, but that it should be better communicated. So I think Harvard should incorporate anti-Semitism training into what it calls its diversity, equity, and inclusion practices. And maybe they should establish better norms of civil engagement. Anyhow, I want to go into something else to conclude the program. After talking about this anti-Semitism, which is really showing itself in its ugly head quite a bit since October 6th, I think it's frustrating that so many are so blinded by hate that they have absolutely no interest in even the basic facts. It is frustrating, and I think it's also frightening, to see the world go insane with anger and hatred. It's frightening, for example, to watch mobs of Arabs and people in kafiyot hunt innocent people in Jewish neighborhoods around the world. And it's frightening to see Jewish stores and synagogues looted, and it's frightening to face the hatred of an enraged world. However, we, the Jews, are people of a different spirit because we have faced hatred before. It has been our legacy to stand tall and block out the noise and block out the hatred. We have always possessed this courage and this different spirit, and our current crisis should be no different than crises in the past. It's interesting. We have stood alone. For centuries, we preached monotheism against pagan gods. We preserved the dignity of humankind, even when there were brutal tyrants. We stood alone. For the past 1,000 years, we have faced malicious hostility, even brutal violence. While we are consistently demonized, but we stood alone. During the nightmare of the Holocaust, Hitler tried to erase the Jews from this planet. He tried to kill all the Jews, and much of the world stood by silently. We stood alone. During the first decades of the State of Israel, hostile Arab countries partnered with the then powerful Soviet Union, an attempt to crush the little state of Israel just as it came into being. We are people of a different spirit. We cannot be intimidated by the violence and the rage that we face. This is our responsibility. For past generations stood tall and stood alone. We have a responsibility to our history. We owe it to our history. They would gladly have traded places with us if they could. We have an independent state. They didn't have a state or an army to protect them. They didn't live in the company of Jewish people returning to their homeland to jointly build a common future. They stood alone, and they were lonely. But we stand alone, today, and we are united. We have a debt to the past generations. We owe it to them to summon our courage and summon our moral conviction and not allow crazed mobs of confused college students to muddle our clarity. Just because hordes of anti-Semites or crowds of bewildered college students vilify us as the aggressors, that doesn't alter the fact that since our return to Israel, we have been ceaselessly attacked. We were the victims of October 7th. We consistently seek peace while our enemies seek death. We owe it to past generations to continue this war to its necessary conclusion, which we alone must determine. We in Israel cannot allow international pressure to prevent us from ending this war a moment sooner than it should, or from defending our country and providing a safer world for our children. We owe it to Jewish history not to. By the way, in the Torah itself, there is a prohibition against soldiers being afraid in war. Obviously, the Torah cannot legislate against the emotion of fear. Rather, it demands that we manage our fear just as we manage our other emotions. There is a thin line between fear and panic, and the Torah warns us against crossing it. We have a different spirit. We have outlasted all our enemies for thousands of years, and we will outlast the present hatred and the present anti-Semitism. And I think it is true that we will not be afraid to stand alone, because that is part of our identity. We are who we are, and we're in a war for our survival. God willing, we will win this war. It's a war not just for the state of Israel. It's a war for all the Jews around the world, and the truth of the matter is, it's a war for humanity. We represent humanity, and therefore, even if we don't get support now, in time to come, people understand the nature of the fight now, a fight of essentially good against evil. We represent good, we will win. Thank you for listening. Let's hope we have a better week than the one we just had. And let's hope that things will work out well in the future, not just for the Jewish people, but for the entire world. Thanks again for listening. Jay Shapiro, signing off.
Be smart. Listen to Israel News Talk Radio in the background while you work and get the latest news and commentary from Israel. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.